Well, we're concluding our four-part series on practicing the way of Jesus. We've been noticing his practices, his regular habits, the things that he did repeatedly. And we're seeking to make them our own because we are followers of Jesus, aren't we? A follower of Jesus is like an apprentice. An apprentice observes the master and does what the master does. An apprentice spends time with the master. That's what it means to be a Christian, spending time with Jesus, getting to know him, doing what he did. Jesus fasted, and he assumed that we would too. He didn't command it, actually. He just assumed that his followers would also fast. And so we've been going through this series, where, and the sermons, the last four sermons, including this one, have been drawn from the practicing the way material. No exception today. This sermon is also based on and drawn from that material. And if you want to go deeper into learning about fasting, you can go onto the Life Group page of our website and download the Practicing the Way Fasting Guide. And there's lots of helpful stuff in there. Now, I'd like to begin by reading you some true stories. Sarah is a new mother in LA, but the father just abandoned her and the baby. She makes barely enough to survive in the city. One week, she paid her utilities, but had no money left to buy groceries. Her fridge was empty and her cupboards bare. She is a new Christian, and in her faltering way, she prayed to God for help and felt a strange peace come over her. A few hours later, she opened the front door of her apartment, and there on the step, or stoop, I don't actually know what that means, I think it's American for step, there were three bags of groceries and an envelope with $200 in it. It was anonymous, but she strongly suspects it's from someone at her church just down the road. That's Sarah. Next story is about the Ngoi family. They are refugees from Congo. They were forced to leave their homeland due to rising violence, and they were granted asylum in the United States. But when they landed at Portland Airport, all their possessions for a family of six were in one plastic garbage bag. They did not speak English, understand the culture, or know how to navigate the complex world of American social services. They were dropped off at a Spartan apartment and left alone. But a few hours later, there was a knock at the door. A community group from the local church was there, carrying bags of groceries and home supplies and offering long-term friendship. That's the Ngoi family. Next story is about Raphael. He is a young professional in Minneapolis. Each day, he sees the growing inequality in the city and the specter of homelessness, not to mention the inequality around the world. But what can one person do in the face of so much pain and suffering? Raphael is an apprentice of Jesus, and every Friday he goes without food until sundown. Each week he takes the money he would have spent on breakfast and lunch and donates it to his local food bank. It's not much, but it is something. Those are true stories of poverty in our world. I wonder, have you ever thought much about poverty? Globally, worldwide, 3.5 billion people, that's 44% of the whole population of the world, live in poverty. That is to say, they live on less than $6.85 a day. 700 million people globally live in extreme poverty. They live on less than $2.15 a day. In the UK, 21% of people live in relative poverty. That's when households have an income that is 60% less than the average UK income of that year. 18% of people live in absolute poverty, and that's when households have an income of 60% less than the UK average, but for a fixed base rate year and adjusted for inflation. Relative poverty measures inequality, whereas absolute poverty measures living standards compared to a fixed point in time. And that was the situation in 2023 and 2024, according to government statistics. Poverty in the UK means when people don't have enough money to or resources to meet basic needs, like not being able to buy food, not being able to afford to heat their home. And when we bear in mind those statistics about poverty, especially in the UK, what's quite shocking is this. Despite this poverty, there is a huge amount of food wastage in the UK. Overall, the UK wastes nearly 10 million tonnes of food per year. A metric tonne is 1,000 kilograms. 22% of all food purchased ends up as waste. And annually in the UK, £17 billion worth of edible food was wasted. This is stats from 2022 by WRAP, which stands for Waste and Resources Action Programme. £17 billion worth of edible food was wasted, which costs the average household £1,000 a year. So in our country, millions struggle to eat enough food, whilst millions of tons of food is thrown away each year. Perfectly good food, edible food. What are we to do about this? What does the Bible say? What's our responsibility as Christians, as followers and apprentices of Jesus? And is there a practice of Jesus which tackles this issue, or at least begins to? Yes, there is. The practice of fasting. Our last three sermons on fasting focused on what fasting does to us to transform ourselves. But this final sermon on fasting, we're going to look at how fasting transforms others, especially those who live in poverty. Throughout church history, Christians have used fasting to move towards the hungry, the poor, the people who live below the poverty line. And I'm guessing that this is an aspect of fasting which is probably quite new to you, certainly is to me. I'd never thought about fasting this way until I read and studied this final part in the series. But what we're going to find out is that fasting is a means of social justice and transformation. And it's Isaiah 58 that teaches us that. So let's go back there. Alison read this earlier, but let's just recap and learn what it's saying to us about fasting being connected with us reaching out and helping the poor. Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen it? Why have we humbled ourselves and you have not noticed? So God's people are fasting. They were back in Isaiah's time, but it's not working. God is not listening. He's not responding. Why, they ask. Let's hear what God says in reply. On the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. Your fasting ends in quarreling and strife and in striking each other with wicked fists. You cannot fast as you do today and expect your voice to be heard on high. Is this the kind of fast I have chosen? Only a day for people to humble themselves? Is it for only bowing one's head like a reed and for lying in sackcloth and ashes? Is this what you call a fast? A day acceptable to the Lord? God is not responding because their fast is a farce. They're fasting, for sure. But at the same time, they're doing as they please, they're exploiting their workers, and they're quarrelling and fighting. God says, is fasting only about abstaining from food and humbling yourselves? Is it? No, God says. There's more to fasting than that. Let's read the next verse. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke. Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them, and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. God doesn't want fasting, which is only abstaining from food and humbling ourselves. He also wants fasting, which changes what we do, especially changes how we treat other people, especially the poor, the hungry, the needy. God wants fasting, which causes us to fight injustice, to free people from oppression, to share our food with the hungry, to provide shelter to refugees and immigrants and those with no home, to clothe the naked, and to meet the practical needs of our families and people around us. And if we do this kind of fasting, look what happens. Your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. Your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and he will say, "Here am I." Wow, what a response from God for that kind of fasting. So as I said, this aspect of fasting that we're looking at today is different to the three previous aspects of fasting that we've considered. It has less to do with ourselves and more to do with others, particularly those who are poverty-stricken. God wants us to practice fasting together with actively practicing generosity and justice for the poor. He wants those things to mesh together. And Christians have been doing this kind of fasting for thousands of years. I wonder whether you were aware of that. I wasn't, actually. So, the Shepherd of Hermas, this is a Christian writing from the early 2nd century. It contains this practice for fasting on Wednesdays and Fridays, as many, many Christians did back then. It says, "Estimate the cost of the food you would have eaten on that day and give that amount to a widow or orphan or someone in need. Be humble in this way, that the one who receives something because of your humility may fill his soul and pray to the Lord for you." That's interesting, isn't it? That's this concept from Isaiah 58. Yes, fast, but do something practical while you're fasting to address the needs of the hungry surrounding you. Gregory of Nyssa, a church father from the 4th century in Cappadocia, that's modern-day Turkey, he said this of fasting: "Give to the hungry what you deny your own appetite." Very simple, isn't it? But it's this aspect of fasting that looks to others, looks outward as well as how fasting transforms us personally and inwardly. And then Caesarius of Arles in France in the 6th century said, "Let us fast in such a way that we lavish our lunches upon the poor, so that we may not store up in our purses what we intended to eat, but rather in the stomachs of the poor." That's very well phrased, isn't it? You see what they're getting at? You see what they're all saying? Use fasting as an opportunity to give to the poor, especially the hungry. They're all saying we can't separate our relationship with God from our relationship with our neighbour. We mustn't. We shouldn't. Christianity and the practices of Christianity must affect those around us as well as our relationship with God. So fasting is a way to both love God and love your neighbour. And this kind of fasting, this Isaiah 58 fasting, it does three things. First of all, it helps us to stand in solidarity with the hungry. So when we regularly choose to go without food, that can put us emotionally in touch with those around the world and in the UK who also regularly go without food, but not by choice, who wish they had more food but haven't. So when we choose to abstain from food, we get in touch emotionally in a caring way with those who are going hungry, not by choice. When we deny our stomachs in this way, our hearts are affected. I think that's one of the key things of this whole sermon, if not the series. Our stomachs affect our hearts. Empty stomachs, which are voluntarily empty, have an effect on our hearts. That's the power of fasting. We start to feel God's compassion. We begin to see the poor not as a stranger, but as a brother or a sister. Our hearts are kind of moved so that we want to reach out somehow to help the poor. I heard that there are some Christian parents who really care about raising kids who are not warped by our greedy, materialistic Western culture. And what they do is once a week with their kids, they just have rice and beans. Apparently that's what the majority of the world eat, a small portion of rice and beans. And that's to teach their children this about fasting and caring for the poor, using food and meals as an intentional act of spiritual formation in the lives of their children. Parents, could you do something similar? Could that be a meal that you have once a week? Just to say, we're aligning ourselves with the poor as Christians because that's what we do, because that's who we are, because that's what God does, because that's what Jesus did. He didn't live a rich, sumptuous life. He lived a plain, ordinary life and hung out with those in poverty and so on. So that's the first thing that Isaiah 58-style fasting does. It helps us stand in solidarity with the hungry. But also, fasting in this way helps us to share what we have. What we don't spend on food due to fasting can be used to give to the poor. For example, like a food bank or a food pantry. There are many of them in Reading. In my local Lidl, just on the Oxford Road, there is this big container, and the idea is you buy an extra can of beans or carton of cereal and you drop it in the container as you leave, and it's called Food Share or something like that, and that food is used to go to poor people, to families especially, who live below the poverty line. There are ways that we can harness the power of fasting to reach out to the hungry. Dorothy Day, the Catholic social activist, said this: "How shall we have the means to help our brother who is in need? We can do without those unnecessary things which become habits: cigarettes, liquor, coffee, tea, candy, sodas, soft drinks, and those foods at meals which only titillate the palate. We all have these habits, the youngest and the oldest. And we have to die to ourselves in order to live. We have to put off the old man and put on Christ." So there are things we can do without with. And we tell ourselves, oh, I can't do without coffee. We say that, don't we? But actually we can. Plenty of food we can do without. And we can use the money that we would have spent on those foods to give to the poor. And doing this helps us to do social justice in a biblical way. That is to say, with actions as well as words. As it says in 1 John chapter 3, verse 16 to 18. "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." Those statistics that I shared at the beginning, about world and UK poverty. Maybe we hear them and we think to ourselves, what can I do in the face of such massive need? We can do this. We can do exactly this. We can fast and free up our resources for those in need. Imagine if every Christian, well, there are 2 billion Christians in the world, maybe more. Imagine if every Christian did this. The resources that would be released to help global hunger. Will you do this? How are you helping those who live in poverty, who go hungry, who haven't got enough to eat? Thirdly, fasting enables us to stand against evil and injustice. So fasting can be a loving, non-violent way to protest against systemic injustice. Listen to New Testament scholar Scott McKnight. He says, food joins humans to other humans because we share meals together. Whenever we give up food intentionally, we refrain from relationships. When a group protests by fasting, they both negate one relationship with the haves and they affirm another relationship with the have-nots. And since the structures of power always have sufficient food, fasting is not only refusing relationship, but it is also protesting the power structures that exist. I find that quite deep, and it's like a thought that I haven't had before. But that is something to think about, isn't it? How fasting has this perhaps surprising aspect of helping us to protest against injustice. Fasting is a way for the powerful to voluntarily align themselves with the powerless, like Jesus did. We can do that. We are the rich and powerful, actually. We live in one of the most rich and powerful nations in the world. But when we fast, we can align ourselves with the hungry, the poor, and the powerless. And we can protest against the massive inequalities that there are. As we heard about at the beginning, people going hungry and millions of tons of food being thrown away. And there's another aspect to this as well. We can use fasting to fight evil and injustice. Because to do that, we must fast and pray. It's interesting. I don't know whether you know that verse, Mark 9:29. It's a fascinating verse because it's not in some Bibles, because it's in some manuscripts and not others. But it's really interesting because in that verse, the disciples, Mark 9:29, if you're interested to look it up later, the disciples, they can't cast out an evil spirit. And then Jesus comes along and does. And they say, why couldn't we? And he says, really interesting what he says, this kind can only come out by prayer and fasting. So the implication is that fasting prepares us for spiritual warfare. That there's a link between fasting and warfare spiritually. So we can purge and purify our souls of sin and grow in power and authority in the spirit to tear down strongholds, as it says in the Bible. Fasting has this aspect to it, and we thought a little bit, didn't we, about that last week when we thought about how fasting helps us for God to hear our voice. So how will you stand against evil and injustice? Will you fast to stand against those things? What changes will you make to your life and your eating habits after this sermon? What changes will I make? How will fasting in our lives become linked to caring for those who are the have-nots, the powerless, the hungry? Well, we've come to the end now of our series on fasting. Maybe you're thinking, phew, that was heavy. Or maybe you're thinking, wow, I learned so much. I never thought about fasting that much before in my whole life as a Christian. But what we've seen is that fasting has the potential to transform our relationships. And if you're not a Christian here today, and you're thinking, what is Christianity all about? It's all about relationships. And fasting is just one way of many to enhance and transform relationships that we have. So fasting, we've seen, has the potential to transform our relationship with Jesus, to awaken a spiritual hunger within, to draw us into spiritual union with Jesus. Fasting also has the potential to transform the relationship we have with our own bodies, to heal our relationship we have with food and pleasure, to starve our flesh and feed our souls and develop self-control and self-denial and so on. And fasting can also transform the relationship we have with God, particularly in prayer, to sharpen our ability to hear God's voice, as well as give us power in our prayers so we know we've reached God and he's heard us. And then it can transform, as we've just heard, our relationship with the poor, the hungry, those in need, so that we stand with those who are suffering and we stand against injustice and unrighteousness. So as we come to the end of the series now, let me ask you, will you integrate fasting into your lifestyle like Jesus did? Remember, you don't have to go on a 40-day fast. Just miss one meal from time to time. Will you do something like that? What action will you take as a result of these four studies on fasting? Will you join with the majority of Christians down through the years, who through church history, for thousands of years, have lived in this pattern of eating modestly, fasting, and then feasting on the Sabbath? Will you realise that Jesus doesn't command us to fast, but he does assume that we will, because he wants us to be hungry for him, to get more of him, to be filled with his fullness of life. Let's spend a few moments quietly reflecting now, looking back on what we've learned, allowing the Spirit to impress on our hearts what we need to learn. And when we've had a few moments of quiet, I'll close with a fasting liturgy.